The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Clinical oncology, physical diagnosis, systemic manifestations, and chemotherapy is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard.
So let's talk a little bit about the mass effects of malignancy. Tumors are going to produce clinical problems as a result of local expansion, the way they work, they press on things. You can see on this CT scan here that the spleen on the left side of the abdomen is, of course, right facing us, is easily the same size as the liver. Well, that's not supposed to be the way things look in there. So you can imagine that this might be a patient who would present with early satiety and weight loss, because this patient can't expand his stomach in an effort to consume an appropriate amount of food necessary to get things in. So treatment of the mass effects can be really about trying to treat the malignancy that's causing the problems. We've talked a little bit about paraneoplastic syndromes, and I think Amita Vasoya did a really good job incorporating some of this a couple of days ago when she covered this, but I would recommend nevertheless that you walk in there and maybe take about 10 minutes of your prep time and just plan to lay these four paraneoplastic syndromes out: Eaton-Lambert, SIADH, hypercalcemia, and erythrocytosis. If you know the etiology, the risk factors, the diagnosis, and the treatment for all four of those, you're going to pretty well be set for whatever paraneoplastic syndrome is going to show up on the boards. Pretty comfortable place to be. Weight loss and malnutrition, commonly associated with malignancies, particularly advanced cancers. The wasting that results as a result of this is known as cachexia. We have now become fairly adept in understanding that much of the cachexia that we see is in and of itself a paraneoplastic problem. We know that the cancer can produce certain factors. Chief among them are going to be cachectin, also known as tumor necrosis factor. This causes cachexia in laboratory animals. We just purify cachectin and inject it into laboratory animals, and they start melting in front of our eyes. This has been found in high levels in patients who have advanced cancer. We also know that proteolysis-inducing factor found in the serum and urine of cachectic cancer patients has been associated with this as well. So you might imagine if we can find that, it might be an early marker that we could use to follow our patients for the potential progression of their malignancy. It's not really taken off quite as we had hoped, but there are still a small but very dedicated group of individuals who are trying to investigate that and to try to develop it as a potential guide for us in oncology in treating our patients and understanding the problem better. So how do you manage weight loss and malnutrition? Well, consider the potential causes. You know, think about those abnormalities of taste and smell, the cancers making things taste bad, the chemotherapy that they're on probably is affecting that as well. Think about the physiologic malfunction of the GI tract, and we kind of shown some examples of that with the CT scans. There's excessive energy demands that are made by the tumor. So the cancer is competing, and in many cases, out-competing normal tissues for whatever nutrients are available. And the body's a failure to adapt energy expenditure to the levels of nutrient intake. These can all be very important factors in dealing with this. So you manage it by treating the underlying disease. And pharmacologically, we had two drugs that are out there. I would know about these, but I'm going to tell you in a minute that I wouldn't recommend them for general use, and I'll tell you why. Megestrol acetate is Megace. It is a progestational agent. We used it for breast cancer for many years. We now have other agents that are available to us that work better and have fewer side effects. So it's fallen out of favor and it's no longer used. The other is dronabinol, which is a cannabinoid marketed under the trade name of Marinol. It's been out there for a little while. So when patients ask me if I believe in medical marijuana, I say, yeah, we've had dronabinol for almost 30 years now. And they look at me, no, I'm talking about stuff that goes in a brownie. Well, if you want to sprinkle it on a brownie, I'd be okay with that, I suppose. But, you know, it's trying to maybe have a little fun with our patients because they want approval to go down and or maybe go to Colorado or Washington and maybe pick up some things. So why am I a little bit down on Megase? Well, if you do a lot of geriatrics, you're probably familiar with something called the Beers List. The Beers List is a description of medications that can be harmful for use in senior citizens and don't play well with other medications that are frequently used in this group of patients. So if you look in terms of numbers needed to treat, if you put patients on Megase, you need about 6 patients to stimulate 1 patient's appetite. You need to treat 12 patients in order to see a weight gain in 1 patient. What does that weight gain look like? Well, it's mostly fluid retention and fat. These people do not gain lean body weight. They just retain a little fluid and they retain a little bit of body fat. At 23 patients, 1 patient dies, usually as a result of thromboembolic disease. So they have a stroke or they have myocardial infarction or they have a pulmonary embolus. So you got a drug with a 4% mortality rate and we're putting it on patients to try to help them feel better and live longer. So these patients, many of whom have life-limiting prognoses anyway, we're putting them on a drug that potentially could end their life prematurely. So as a result of that, most of the circles are kind of coming back now against Megase, and we're really having a reconsideration. Now, Marinol admittedly can stimulate your appetite, and it may help you feel better. It may help you adjunctively manage other symptoms. So it's not a completely bad drug. My experience with Marinol is that patients really don't gain a lot of weight taking it. They may feel better, and that in and of itself is probably a reason to at least consider it for use in patients who have symptoms and side effects that we might be able to help. But it's not like they're going to gain 10 pounds in the next month. It just doesn't seem like the munchy effect that we'd hoped for has really kicked in the way we'd hoped it would. Fever is another common problem. It's usually attributable to infection. Sometimes, however, the cancer will produce certain chemicals that cause release of interleukin-1, also known as endogenous pyrogen, and we have to deal with a tumor-related fever or tumor fever. When these patients get infected, they usually get infected with unusual organisms they would usually be able to fight off. But they oftentimes will get infected with organisms that are very common that they would be able to fight off as well. So you have to be very open-minded when you're evaluating these patients. Keep all of the organisms that are potential culprits on the plate as you're evaluating them accordingly. So it's mostly fever. So in a lot of cases, these patients will get an empiric trial of an antibiotic trying to address some of those things. And it's not until later when you've initiated that trial for a few days or you've noticed that there is a pattern to the fever. Most of the time with infection, as we know, there's really no established pattern to the fever. Whereas with tumor fever, there does appear to be a relatively significant pattern, typically in the mid to late afternoon hours. We've also got some hematologic abnormalities to think about here too. Anemia. Anemia is very frequent in advanced stages of malignancy. There's increased destruction of erythrocytes that can result from hypersplenism, microangiopathic hemolysis. Jerry spent a little time in the last hour talking about that. Autoantibodies can be developed as well. Anemia due to bleeding is one of the cardinal features of gastrointestinal malignancies. These nutritional deficits also can result in decreased red cell production. And the anemia of chronic disease really plays into with these patients as well. So certainly something to consider. Green lymphocytopenia and thrombocytopenia are frequently seen as well. These can be commonly seen with chemotherapy, but you can also have them with marrow infiltration. And here in the slide, you can see a picture of a bone marrow. This is a patient that I took care of several years ago who was several years out from her diagnosis of breast cancer. She'd been doing well, no evidence of active disease anywhere. She'd been in remission for several years and was actually off therapy. And she got sent back in by her primary care physician, who's a general internist and an ACOI member, and his concern was that she's developing progressive neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. Well, we do all the good things that a hematologist is supposed to do. We look at temporal factors, we look at medications that they're taking, we try to make a few adjustments. Nothing really stood out, and so we restaged her cancer. No evidence that she had any evidence of active cancer at all. So I said, well, when in doubt, you need a marrow examination. So I took her down and sampled her marrow, and this is what it looked like. And what you've got here are adenocarcinoma cells that are present in the bone marrow. She had no other evidence of disease but her disease in the bone marrow. Went back and took a look at her cancer histology. She historically was ER positive. We tested this for estrogen receptors. She was still ER positive. Placed her on a course of anastrozole, which is an anti-estrogen therapy. Within 3 months, her counts had normalized, and she was feeling much better. So we were able to get her into a remission, but her only sign of progression at all was some abnormal laboratory abnormalities that ultimately proved to be metastatic disease in her marrow. Coagulopathies can occur as well. Typically, you're going to think of mucin-producing adenocarcinomas as being in risk here. So think about non-small cell lung cancer. Think about those mucinous adenocarcinomas of the colon and rectum and pancreas. Those are going to be the primary culprits here. Trousseau syndrome, which we all know is migratory thrombophlebitis, it can also produce venous thrombosis and pulmonary embolism. There's a little known story in that when Trousseau originally reported his syndrome in the French Medical Journal, you know, close to 150 years ago now, described as phlegmatous cerulea dolens, 1/3 of Trousseau's patients were ultimately proven to have a malignancy. And Trousseau himself actually succumbed secondary to the syndrome that he described. It was discovered shortly before his death that he had metastatic pancreatic carcinoma as well. So think about that correlation. You may see that in these patients. Hypercoagulable states can be associated with non-bacterial endocarditis, and resultant thromboembolic episodes as well. So to manage these things, obviously you treat the underlying problem. That's the way you're supposed to fix it. I would grant that when it comes to oncology, that may be easier said than done. But that's the right answer on the board exam. You treat the underlying problem. Low molecular weight heparin is the standard treatment. There's an American Society of Clinical Oncology guideline for how to manage patients at high risk of thromboembolism or patients who have had DVT. Low molecular weight heparin on a daily basis is considered to be the standard of care for these patients. So it's not the new anticoagulants. It's not warfarin. It's low molecular weight heparin. So if you're working these patients up, remember, we're kind of cruise through this quickly because everybody pretty well knows this, but just over a couple of minutes, we'll just kind of remind each other of this. So the three general goals you have in a cancer-related evaluation: you want a biopsy to establish a diagnosis, you want to stage the patient to determine the extent of the tumor, and you want to determine the overall effects of the cancer on the health and performance of the patient. We call that the performance status. We've got cancer screening that's available to us, and we all think about the exfoliative cytology or pap smear for cervical carcinoma, fecal occult blood testing with periodic sigmoidoscopy or colonoscopy. We all know about mammograms, and we all know about digital rectal examination, along with that discussion of PSA in patients for prostate cancer. And we've talked, I think, also about that Preventive Services Task Force recommendation about what you do about this. I tend to be a prostate cancer screening proponent, but I would readily admit that in men who are at low risk for that, you probably need to consider how to modify that recommendation to best suit the needs of the patient. I still think that concept of individualized care, rather than painting this with a broad brush and saying we're doing this for everybody, is probably a little bit better place. And, you know, you kind of look at the incidence of prostate cancer, it's the number one cancer in men, you sort of feel obligated to offer something up to evaluate those who might be at an increased risk. Pathologic diagnosis, you can do it for two reasons. Number one, you establish a diagnosis. Number two, you establish that the abnormalities that you're seeing are not due to a non-malignant cause. This can involve a surgical operation, local excision, removal of tissue. In the CT scan here, you see a needle going in. That's not a heart, by the way. It's a large left upper lobe mass going in, getting some tissue for diagnosis. You can do it bronchoscopy, a wide variety of things that you can do to properly evaluate that patient. And then you go through that process known as staging. Now, the reason that we stage patients is really threefold. Number one, it helps us optimally plan treatment so that we can approach this accordingly. Number two, it provides evaluation to better determine prognosis. Lots of times we're in that situation, doc, what does this mean? What are my options? How long have I got? Those are the things that patients really, really want to know. Am I going to die tomorrow? Am I going to die in 20 years? I need some information. And number three, For those patients who are interested in pursuing clinical trials, it allows us to determine the disease extent accurately so that we understand how to do two things. How we can apply what we've learned in clinical trials to the treatment of the patient. Number two, how the patient might be to consider to be included for new clinical trials that are out there. So it allows us to really match those things up. The TNM system, it varies based on the malignancy, and I don't think you're going to get any specific questions on the board exam about staging. I don't remember any when I took it. I talked with a lot of people over the years. They said, yeah, you know, they really don't. They kind of pick out little subsets of patients, and you know, what do you do with the patient who comes in with this? What do you do with the patient who comes in with that? I wasn't asked to do the TNM staging for anybody, so that's good news. But having a general concept about how this works, I think particularly for the first-timers, is really going to help you. So it's TNM, tumor nodes metastasis, and then what we will do is we will put that into various stages. Remember, the higher the stage, the greater the extent of disease, and for most cancers, the worse the prognosis for that individual patient who has that. No talk on chemotherapy would be complete without some mention of the cell cycle. And yeah, it's a little bit painful, but we'll try to get through this here the best way we can. The cell cycle, the cell growth and that whole process really involves some Hertzian kinetics. And we all remember this from microbiology, right? You've got this sigmoid curve out there, and we remember that early on, there appears to be a fairly low burden of cancer, and it seems to really, really take off. So the concept of Gump-Hertzian kinetics is that as the mass increases, exponential retardation of growth occurs. And why is that? Well, that occurs because there's more cancer to feed and fewer nutrients around to feed it. So the overall growth of the cancer tends to slow a little bit to allow for a better balance because it just can't grow as fast in a more competitive environment. Now, I don't know anybody who's ever measured a tumor doubling time. I don't know anybody, you know, you can't order it or anything like that, but there's a concept out there about how fast cancers grow, and we get that from our experience, but we also get it from historical biological experiments in terms of understanding how fast one cell becomes two cells become four. So a tumor doubling time is the time required for a doubling of tumor volume. It's influenced by the cell cycle time, the fraction of cells undergoing cell division, the rate of cell loss from the mass, because you know there is going to be a bit of die-off with any sort of cancer. The average number of divisions it takes for a cancer to become clinically apparent is 30. 30 doublings. That gives us about 1 times 10 to the 9 cells. The average number of divisions for a cancer to be lethal is 40 doublings, 1 times 10 to the 12th. So if you just sit down and you do the math real quick, that means that by the time we discover cancers, in most cases, that cancer has lived 75% of its life between the time it goes from one dead cell to the time that there's enough cancer to kill the patient. So it kind of looks like this on this growth curve. You can see here where the detection kicks in, and you can see here where deaths would occur, 10 to the 12 cells. So where do oncologists work? Well, they work right here in terms of looking at what the treatment effect. So our hope is that when we administer whatever therapy we're administering, radiation, chemotherapy, biologic agents, we're trying to do is to lower the number of cells. Now, you'll notice in between treatments, there's a little bit of growth that comes back. It's not perfect, but we keep doing successive reductions. So your friendly neighborhood oncologist, when you get back home, you're going to find them on the hillside of this Gump-Hertzian curve. That's us out there with our little lunch bucket and our thermos of coffee, trying to work to see what we can do to bring that down in our patients to try to see if we can improve the quality of our lives. That's really at the root of what oncologists do. So in understanding how the cell cycle plays into that, remember that we've got a process that goes on. We've got mitosis, and then we've got two growth phases, and separating that two growth phases is a synthesis where the DNA is created. So we have drugs that affect those particular areas. So it's kind of what this looks like. You've got this mitosis and then two growth periods and a synthesis. So a cell cycle is time from one mitosis to another mitosis. Chemotherapy is going to affect cells in direct relationship to how active they are in that cycle. And we've got some other other drugs that are out there. You know, we've got hormonal therapies, we've got biological agents. They may or may not have a role to play with the cell cycle. It's not entirely clear. Probably not germane for a test question. So just to kind of give you a little bit of reassurance. So looking at this, we've got our classes of drugs. We talked a little bit about alkylating agents as being the largest group that we have. Alkylating agents are going to bind to DNA and cause cross-strand breaks that disrupt transcription and replication. So meclorethamine, nitrogen mustard, is an alkylating agent. Cyclophosphamide, nitrosoureas, and platinum derivatives. So drugs like cisplatin, carboplatin, which we use for a lot of cancers, drugs like oxaliplatin that we use for gastrointestinal malignancies are in that group as well. These are going to, for the most part, be cell cycle non-specific. They'll pretty much kill cancer no matter where it is. We do have a drug class that's much more specific, however, and these are the anti-metabolites. They compete with normal precursors for the catalytic sites of key enzymes, or they substitute for metabolites that are incorporated into DNA or RNA. So you might imagine it sounds like a bit more specific function here, and it is. So things like methotrexate, pemetrexed are going to play into that. Also, some of these drugs are kind of named for where they would work. 5-FU doesn't sound like much, but think about 5-fluorouracil. Uracil, well, isn't that a nucleic acid? Yeah, sure is. We use it in RNA, right? Arsine doesn't mean much, but if you know the other name, cytosine, arabinoside, that's another nucleic acid. Well, that would be a pretty specific thing, too. Gemcitabine doesn't mean too much. Its chemical name, deoxydifluorocytidine. Hey, there's another nucleic acid. So some of these, 6-mercaptopurine, 6-thioguanine, if you kind of get a sense about that name, you probably can plug it into where it's going to work. Now, these obviously are very specific, and so you might imagine that they're going to be cell cycle specific, and you'd be right. An anti-metabolite is going to be a cell cycle specific agent. What about antibiotics? Believe it or not, antibiotics have tumor-related properties. Now, they're not typically thought of as antibiotics anymore, but they were originally developed as antibiotics, and so that's where the term of antibiotics in cancer drugs comes in. Antibiotics circulate with DNA, and they cause inhibition of transcription and replication. They also inhibit topoisomerase II. Now, for the more senior physicians who may not have heard a whole lot about topoisomerase II, remember that we've got all this chromosomal material that's got to fit into this little teeny tiny nucleus, and so it's going to get bent and folded and all sorts of stuff and wrapped up. Well, these are known as unfolding proteins, and so the topoisomerases literally go in, they'll unfold a part of DNA, it'll get transcribed, and it'll get stuck back together. So they control that operation. Dr. Rubicin, known by the trade name of Adriamycin, and Donarubicin, Actinomycin D, we don't use that much anymore. Bleomycin, not used as often as it used to be, but still definitely out there. These are all cell cycle non-specific agents. Plant alkaloids. If you've got vincas or periwinkles growing around your place, you're growing chemotherapy right out there in the wild. Pretty cool. They go by the name of vinc. So anything that starts with vinca or vino or something like that, it's not just for wine anymore. Those are going to be plant alkaloids. So vincristine, vinblastine, vinorelbine, known as enalabine, and vindazine are plant alkaloids. They bind to tubulin, cause impairment of microtubule formation. We've also got epidophyllotoxins, and so things like etoposide, VP16. I don't know what happened to VPs 1 through 15, but we use a lot of VP16. It, too, inhibits topoisomerase 2. It causes single-strand breaks in DNA. These work at a very specific point in the cell cycle, so they're going to be cell cycle-specific agents. And we've got a large number of hormonal agents, too. So we've got tamoxifen. We'll talk about it in breast cancer. We've got agents like leuprolide and doserelin that are LHRH agonists. Decreased secretion of luteinizing hormone, decreased sex hormone production, use a lot of these in prostate cancers. We've also got flutamide and bicalutamide. They bind to and block testosterone receptors. I jokingly tell the guys with prostate cancer, this is tamoxifen for men. So it gets in and blocks testosterone receptors. There's another one coming down the developmental pipeline. It either has just been released or will be released later. But given the lag that we have in about 2 years between the time stuff like this comes out and the time it shows up on the boards, I don't think you really need to worry about that new agent at this point. We also have aromatase inhibitors, anastrozole, exemestane, and letrozole. These are effective in postmenopausal women with breast cancer. So aromatase is the last step in converting androgens to estrogens in the adrenal gland, and this shuts that process off. You might look at that and go, hey, you know, I'm pretty savvy when in chronology. It seems to me like if you're shutting off conversion of androgens to estrogens, wouldn't you get an accumulation of androgens and have masculinizing features in your patient? It's not a problem. We've been concerned about it. It's never been a problem that we've been able to document. We now have experience with a couple of million women treated worldwide over the last 20 or 25 years that these agents have been available. So certainly adjust concern early on. It's not turned out to be an issue for us in taking care of these patients. Biological agents, interferons and interleukins. The only thing I think you need to know about this is that they cause stimulation of the immune system, probably have a role that's very unclear. I don't think they're going to get you lost in the weeds. Now, if you're taking an oncology certification, yeah, you know, the weeds are what matter to us. But I think for internal medicine, they're going to stay out of the weeds on this. We've also got some newer agents to talk about. Epidermal growth factor inhibitors, things like erlotinib or Tarceva. It is effective in non-small cell lung cancer. Now that we're better able to select our patient populations, I think we make better choices with these agents. And we've seen a reasonably successful therapy in a small group of patients with this. We also have things like cetuximab. It's effective in lung cancer, head and neck cancer, colorectal cancer. And the challenge is that these patients have to be KRAS wild type. If they're KRAS mutated, this agent is not effective in that patient population. And we've talked a little bit about tyrosine kinase inhibitors. These are effective in chronic myelocytic leukemia. It's also been effective in GI stromal tumors, where we see some activity as well. Monoclonal antibodies. You know, we get a monoclonal antibody about every other week in our line of work. These are targeted therapies that are intended to direct the immune system at the malignancy. The one that really got marketed first for general use was rituximab. It's targeted at CD20. It binds to lymphocytes, and it's effective in lymphomas, chronic lymphocytic leukemias. And as we've now discovered, it appears to be available for a wide variety of increasingly non-malignant uses as well. So, you know, we've often joked about how gastroenterologists and rheumatologists are frustrated oncologists because they keep borrowing the stuff that we've used for a long time. And I think it's really exciting to see its uses expanded as the years go by. Cetuximab is directed at epidermal growth factor. It affects tyrosine kinase activity. We talked about that one. Alemtuzumab, marketed under the trade name Campath. We've really not seen this agent take off. It still has its adherence. It's a CD52 monoclonal antibody. It is effective in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Other agents that have been targeted with isotopes, and so they've marketed under the trade names of things like Zevalin and Bexar. They have been used with some extent and with some success in refractory lymphomas. I think they'll probably stay away from those, but you've got it in front of you just in case. We now have some newer targeted therapies, and so we're targeting some of the epitopes that are involved in the way the immune system responds to the cancer. So CTLA-4 was really the first. Ipilimumab, marketed under the trade name Yervoy, has been useful in melanoma. There's some early data that suggests it may be effective in renal cell carcinoma as well, so we're excited about that. And then more recently, the PD-1, programmed cell death 1, and PD-L1, it's the ligand of that, effective with drugs like nivolumab and pembrolizumab. We've seen activity in non-small cell lung cancer, and now for the first time, we're seeing some early activity in small cell lung cancer as well. So the exciting thing for that is these agents may be the first new drug approved to treat small cell lung cancer in over 25 years. That's saying a lot for the utility of these agents. So we're seeing emerging data sets in other malignancies. At this point, you only need to know about non-small cell lung cancer. The other stuff is just too new. But you'll see things called the checkmate trials and things like that getting promoted. So I've included this. Again, these are going to affect T cells. And that's the whole idea, is to try to restore some of these checkpoints where the immune system gets checked. As you can see, there are four other sites that are currently undergoing investigation. So these things are going to be like cephalosporins as the years go by. You're going to hear a lot more about these, and it's an exciting time for us. I think there's just two or three or four drugs that you need to know about right now that we've mentioned. Chemotherapy causes complications, to be sure. constitutional complaints are going to occur in more than 90% of patients. Fatigue, weakness, anorexia, those sorts of things are all going to be components. And so we've got about three or four slides to cruise through quickly here. Alkylating agents are going to be the primary culprits for GI toxicity, so nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, mucositis. There is one thing that I think you really need to know about, and that is that with anti-CD20 therapy, particularly with rituximab, you need to be aware that this can reactivate hepatitis B virus in those patients who are hepatitis B virus positive. So you got to make sure you check hepatitis B virus serologies in those patients. Reactivation can be a real problem. People have developed fulminant hepatic necrosis and death with it. Respiratory complaints, Busol family, bleomycin, mitomycin C, pulmonary fibrosis, think about typical Busol in lung and you get a sense about what that looks like. These people are almost always going to have abnormal PFTs, so we'll kind of keep those in mind moving forward. Dermatologic, think about hand-foot syndrome, most commonly with 5-FU, acroerythema, just the very tips of fingers and toes, and in men, the penis can become effective with this. I showed you a picture about what hand-foot syndrome looks like. Skin rash, epidermal growth factor receptors, EGFR stands for epidermal. These patients can develop an acneiform rash, certainly something to be aware of as well. Lastly, genitourinary problems. Think about agents that are nephrotoxic. So the ones we would worry about, hydrocyclophosphamide and ifosfamide, they can cause hemorrhagic cystitis. You can avoid that risk with hydration. Platinum compounds can cause nephrotoxicity. Hydrate those patients to the best of your ability. All right, and the rest of these I think are pretty straightforward, so we'll just let you review. One that I did want to point out here before I close, hypophysitis with ipilimumab and hypothyroidism with those PD-1 and PD-L1 agents, those are certainly concerns as well. And we're seeing an increasing number of patients who are presenting with these. These can be longer acting and more problematic as we go forward.